Thanks, Kendrick. So I'm Kiyoshi Masui. I lead the MIT Synoptic Radio Lab, and I'm going to tell you about fast radio bursts, and also how this sort of digitally driven telescope called CHIME is allowing us to understand them and giving us a sort of like a wide field view of FRBs for the first time and letting us really drill down and figure out what they are. And then I'm going to finish up by saying how you might use them as probes of the universe for cosmology. Okay, so let's start with what are fast radio bursts? So fast radio bursts are single radio flashes. They're very brief. They're typically milliseconds in duration. They're broadband, so they're observed from 200 megahertz up to 8 gigahertz. And they're fairly bright. So they're in the 1 to 100 Jansky range. So Jansky is a unit of flux that's used in radio astronomy. And it's the brightness of a typical radio galaxy. So depending on what frequency you're observing at, in every square degree on the sky, there might be one Jansky source, which is typically an AGN or a star-forming galaxy. And they're cosmologically distant, but typically, poorly, I'll give it 1 second. They're cosmologically distant, but typically fairly poorly localized, right? So we don't know precisely where a given fast radio burst is coming from because of the instruments that are used to detect them, which I'll talk about in detail a little bit later. They are almost certainly related to neutron stars in some way, shape, or form, and that comes mostly just from the time scale. They're milliseconds in duration, right? And so by causality, the light emitting region can't be bigger than a light millisecond, otherwise you'd have geometric broadening. A light millisecond is 300 kilometers, and you know what objects in the universe plausibly have the energy reservoirs to create bright radio flashes that you can see from cosmological distances? Only neutron stars or exotic things, you know, things that involve new physics. So they're almost certainly related to neutron stars in some way, shape, or form, and I'll talk about that a little bit later as well. Perhaps the defining feature of fast radio bursts is this property of dispersion. Okay? So that's just saying that these bursts, they're very brief and very broad band, right? So, you know, the initial pulse might look like that and has many spectral components, okay? But as it propagates through a medium, through the plasma that permeates outer space, that light doesn't travel quite at the speed of light. It travels a little bit slower because that plasma has a refractive index. That refractive index is wavelength dependent. That's what it means to be dispersive. That's what the word dispersion means. And so the long wavelengths, the redder light, if you will, travels through the plasma a little bit slower than the shorter wavelengths, the bluer light. It's all radio waves, but you know, bluish, if you will. And so those shorter wavelengths get ahead of the longer wavelengths and arrive a little bit before the longer wavelengths. So if you want to see what that looks like in real data, so here's some real data. So this is a dynamic spectrum. So the color scale is just sort of the power being observed in a radio telescope in some units that radio astronomers use. As a function of both observing frequency and time, here's a fast radio burst, right? So at a fixed wavelength, a fixed frequency, this burst is, you know, a little blip. It's a millisecond long flash. That flash happens at a different time at every frequency, right? And with the long wavelengths, so the low frequencies arriving after the short wavelengths, the high frequencies. Okay? And so it's a millisecond long flash, but the arrival times are spread out over second timescales. And so this is very powerful, right? So for one, this can be very precisely measured, right? This total time delay I said is seconds, right? Where the pulse width is like milliseconds. And so I get to measure this time delay to a part in 1,000 precision or better. It turns out the time delay is proportional to the wavelength squared, and the proportionality constant involves fundamental constants that we know, along with this thing called the dispersion measure. The dispersion measure just tells you the total amount of plasma along the line of sight, right? It's the line integral or the path integral of the plasma density, right? So it's the area density or the column density of free electrons along the line of sight. It's measured in these silly units, right, which is parsecs per centimeter cubed, right? So it's just because NE is mostly, the electron density is most naturally measured in inverse centimeter cubed. DS is most naturally measured in parsecs. So parsecs per centimeter cube, but still really an area density, one over area. We're giving you the area density of electrons along between us and the source. And this is really powerful because it tells you something about where the FRB is, right? So this dispersion, you know, this line integral can get get contributions from, you know, the Milky Way, the host galaxy, but, you know, actually most of it comes from the intergalactic medium, right? The plasma, the very, very low density plasma that permeates sort of the entire universe. And this piece is going to correlate very strongly with distance, because the further away you are, the more opportunity there is for plasma to be between you and us and the source. Okay, and this has led to the famous so-called McCart relation after J.P. McCart, which for a handful of FRBs that have been localized with interferometers, for which we've measured redshifts, you can measure the dispersion measure, and you see that they correlate very, very strongly. Right, and that's just because the further away you are, the higher redshift you are, the more dispersion you accumulate by going through this intergalactic medium. And that gives you a very crude redshift measurement for every single FRB. So that gives you maybe a few tens of percent precision on the distance.
If you don't force this line to go through 0, 0.
Yeah, so here this Milky Way contribution, a model for it has already been subtracted off.
Right.
So that which means you would like it, which is trying to get that line to go through 0, 0. In practice, that is uncertain in itself. But is that uncertainty is smaller than the uncertainty that comes from smaller than the uncertainty that comes from both the large scale structure and then the big one is the host component there.
Yeah, exactly. Right, so if you don't force it to go through 0, 0, then it seems that the best fit, you know, would pass the y-axis at some non-zero y-value, shouldn't it? Mm-hmm.
So you can, so in this fit, they did fit a y-intercept for an unaccounted for local piece. And they've subtracted off of that. I think they've subtracted that off both the data and the fit, as I recall. So there is a parameter. There is parameter inference that's happened here to massage both the data points and the line.
Okay.
I will say that this is not all the data. So this is the original, you know, six data points that confirmed this relationship. Now it's more like, you know, two dozen data points. But, you know, I think I like to show this one because it's the seminal work. It's a homage to JP who passed away very shortly after publishing this paper. There's more data than this now. Maybe the last thing I'll say in terms of introduction to FRBs is that how numerous they are, right? So they're much less energetic than, say, supernova or gamma ray bursts, but they're far, far more abundant. So in the first decade of this field, something like 50 fast radio bursts had been observed. But that's just because it's really, really hard to observe a fast radio burst, right? They last a millisecond. You get one shot to see them. You have to be looking at exactly the right place at the right time. And the field of view of a typical radio telescope like this one might be a tenth of a square degree. And so you extrapolate the FRBs that were observed to the full sky, and you come up with something like thousands per sky per day, right? And so they're a very, very abundant phenomenon. So which brings me to the next point, right? So if we want to make progress in this field, we have to do a little bit better than seeing a few dozen over a decade, okay? We need a larger sample in order to study, and so we need to find more of these things. And in order to find more, to get a bigger sample, you need sort of a new type of telescope, right? It's not, the telescopes that existed in 2017 aren't up to the task of finding giant samples. And so why is that, right? So what limits a telescope like the Green Bank telescope? What makes it unable to find, say, thousands of fast radio bursts? So how does a telescope, the Green Bank telescope, work? So it works just like an optical telescope, right? It's got a giant mirror. Okay, light comes in, right? No, it's all good. They moved, I think, from there to there. okay, so it's got a giant mirror, okay? And that mirror has two jobs, right? So for one, it's just a light bucket, right? You want to have as much light coming from the sky to hit your mirror as possible so you can collect as much of it as possible, right? But the geometry of the mirror has to be special and that has to also focus the light. You want the geometry to be just right so that light coming from a certain direction bounces off and the path lengths are all exactly the same, so that it adds up constructively at the focus there, right? That constructive interference gives you the sort of the amplification that you want, right? So that means that you're actually using all that light to get more signal, right? But it's actually doing another thing. It's more than just amplification. It's also giving you spatial resolution. That's because light coming from a different direction bounces off this mirror, and the path lengths don't add up just right. They to land there, they would add up somewhere else in the focal plane. They would add up somewhere else in the focal plane, right? And so only light coming from that one direction adds up constructively at that particular point, which means you're only sensitive to light coming from the one direction. That's resolution, right? Your ability to distinguish which direction the light is coming from, right? So what limits a telescope that's designed like this, right?
Is it possible to have two simultaneous sources?
Yeah, well, so what you can do is you can do what you do in the optical, right? Is you add pixels to the focal plane, right? You could have, in the optical, you have a CCD and you populate this focal plane with thousands of detectors. And you get light coming from many, many different directions at a time. That turns out to be hard in the radio because each pixel has to be a sort of wavelength scale. So each one of those is physically large, right? And so you can only fit so much of that focal plane. It is definitely true that one pixel is not, even GBT could accommodate maybe a dozen pixels or something. But that gets you a factor of 10 maybe. But I'll make an argument that you can do even better with other methods. All right, so what's the limiting factor here, right? So why can't I build, you know, 1,000, if I want to detect 1,000 times more FRBs, then surely I can build 1,000 GBTs, right? Or maybe 100 GBTs, each with 10 pixels at the focus. And the reason you don't want to do that is because GBT is crazy expensive, right? And it's just from sheer scale, right? This mirror in the radio has to be the size of a Canadian football field, which is, 10% bigger than an American football field. It has to point anywhere on the sky with sort of arc minute precision, and that's just really, really expensive to build, right? And it's the mechanical cost that really dominates, building thousands of these things. The reason you can't do it. So if you don't want to do that, how else would you design a radio telescope? All right. And I thought, never been heckled before. Tell everyone stay away from perimeter. Okay. So new technology actually enables you to build a completely different type of radio telescope. And two technologies in particular that I'll focus on are the scalability of modern computation. So that's driven by consumer products like graphics processing units that have dramatically decreased the cost of digital signal processing. Okay, and so now I have the ability to do a large scale compute. And then the other technology that really enables this is the commoditization of radio frequency devices for the communications industry. So, and in fact, the amplifier, right, that you put at the focus of GBT here, right, you can afford, GBT is like a $100 million telescope. You can afford to spend any amount of money you want on the amplifier at the focus, say $10 million. You can cryogenically cool it. You can go through great efforts because, it's sitting on top of a very expensive telescope, right? So most of you in your pockets have a cell phone, and that cell phone will have an amplifier in it. That amplifier is twice as noisy as the one at GBT. and it costs like, you know, 40 cents or something. And so if you have those two technologies, right, if you can build very low cost, very high performance amplifiers, not quite as good as the ones that are cryogenically cooled, but pretty good, you can envisage taking a completely different approach. Instead of having a big mirror, you just carpet the ground with antennas, right? Collect all the light, okay? You can afford to collect all that light because amplifiers are cheap, right? So on each one of these antennas, you have an amplifier and you collect that light and you digitize it. So you've done one of the jobs, you've done the light bucket job of the mirror, but you haven't focused the light, right? So to focus that light, you just do it all in software and with digital signal processing. Okay? So how does that work in detail? Well, one way to think about this is with what's called beamforming. So imagine you have an array of antennas like this, okay? And you have some incoming wave, and you want to point your telescope, you want to focus the light on that wave there, okay? So your antennas digitize the signal, and they get a waveform, right? And there's a geometric delay between each of these antennas because of the angle the wave is coming in from. I apply some steering delay to line those up. I sum it, and I get constructive interference. And I have sensitivity to that wavefront. And then if there's another wavefront coming in from a different direction where I haven't focused, where I don't want to focus my telescope, then the steering delays I applied do not line up the light. I get destructive interference, and I don't have sensitivity to that direction. Right? And so I've both collected that light to get my amplification, and I've pointed my telescope. I've got my resolution. So this is the advantage that you can point your telescope anywhere on the sky you want with no moving parts, right? But furthermore, you can point your telescope everywhere on the sky simultaneously with no moving parts. This is all just software. I can duplicate my software as many times as I want and point my telescope in as many directions simultaneously as I have compute for. So without further ado, let me introduce the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, or CHIME. CHIME is a digitally driven telescope operating between 400 and 800 megahertz. It's a very large field of view and a very high sensitivity, which gives it the ability to detect something like 1,000 FRBs a year in comparison to something like 50 FRBs a year for all other telescopes combined. CHIME is a collaboration between these institutions. Here's Perimeter. So how does CHIME work, right? So I lied to you a little bit. So CHIME does have a giant mirror, okay? But that mirror is only curved in one dimension, in the east-west dimension, so it only focuses the light in 1D. Okay? And the other dimension, it's flat, so it leaves the light unfocused. Okay? So the field of view, our receiver up here that collects that light, the pixel, right? It has a response that basically sees horizon to horizon in the north-south direction because we didn't bother focusing our light in the north-south direction, but it has a narrow response in the east-west direction. Okay, but we don't just have one receiver along at the focal line. We have a whole line of receivers here. Okay, and so we do that digital beamforming process in the north-south direction. That gives us both amplification and spatial resolution north-south. Furthermore, we didn't build just one of these cylinders, but four of these cylindrical reflectors do an additional stage of beamforming east-west, which gives us another factor of four, more sensitivity, more amplification, and spatial information in the east-west direction. So this beamformer was built by Chiriang, who was formerly at Toronto and worked with the SETI Institute. And I haven't quite been able to figure out what her current, she just changed affiliations, and I haven't been able to figure out exactly how it works, but anyway. CHIME. CHIME has no moving parts, right? So it always steers straight up and sees a strip of the sky from horizon to horizon, north-south. So that means we don't have the ability to point our telescope outside of the field of view, and so there's only one strip of the sky that you can see. Fortuitously, the Earth turns, that means we get to map out the full northern sky every day. A few more details about CHIME. So it's at the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory in Penticton, BC. This is the observing band I already mentioned. It's about an 80 meter by 80 meter total aperture, giving it something like half degree resolution. So in terms of total scale, you know, this is kind of football field scale, not quite the size of GBT, but getting pretty close. And it's instrumented with 1,000 of these dual polarization antennas up at the focal line. But really, the heart and soul of Chime is not that steel you see on the ground. It's in the computer. It's in the computers and the containers that sit beside Chime, right? So it's this digitally driven aspect that really makes Chime powerful. So its correlator has, you know, 1,000 analog to digital converters that are hosted by 128 FPGA boards, producing 6.6 terabits of data every second that gets focused, that gets, you know, pointed on a 256 node cluster. Each one of those nodes has 4 GPUs in it, and they do 6.7 peta operations per second, which is about 6 times as much as ALMA's correlator, which is the next biggest radio correlator. But the thing that makes Chime really powerful is this idea of commensality, right? So Chime points digitally, right? As there's no scarce resource in terms of like, where do I point my telescope? It's always pointing in the same place. And all that digital pointing it does, that's just software, can be duplicated, right? And so you can do multiple surveys or do multiple science goals at the same time. Right, and so it can do 21 centimeter intensity mapping, the fast radio burst search that I'm talking about today. It also has a 21 centimeter absorber search. It has a highly multiplexed pulsar timing backend and a slow pulsar search. And it does all these simultaneously. Right, these are one telescope feeding many, many backends, all operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. All right, so drilling down on the fast radio burst search, how does that work? So we have that digital beamformer produces 1,000 form beams, right? So that lives right here. Each of those beams has 16,000 spectral channels, so fairly high spectral resolution covering the band, and is sampled at 1 millisecond. And that's processed by an FRB search backend that Kendrick designed and wrote a lot of the software for, which is a 128 node CPU cluster, okay? And this all has to happen in real time, right? So if I multiply this number by this number and divide by that number, you get a data rate that is much, much too high to write to disk. And therefore, you have to search. This search has to happen in real time. You can't afford to store any of that data. Okay? However, this has some limitations. So this pipeline is highly optimized to find fast radio bursts, to discover fast radio bursts. It's not very well optimized to study them, right? So in particular, there's no polarization sensitivity. We just can't afford to keep all that polarization information when we want to search for in Stokes' eye and unpolarized light. We have limited time resolution, right? So the duration of the burst is something like 1 millisecond. That's good. So we have 1 millisecond readout, that's great for finding the fast radio bursts. It's optimized for finding the fast radio bursts. But if you want to study their morphology afterwards, you'd like to have more information, right? And we don't. The spectral resolution is similarly limited. And in particular, you have a very limited ability to localize events on the sky, right? So you're sort of stuck with the diffraction limit of the telescope. You've already pointed your telescope, and the resolution limit is something like 1/4 degree. You can overcome many of these limitations with the system that I was most involved in creating, which is the triggered baseband recording system. So what you do there is you take the raw phase-preserving measurements of the electric fields that are captured by the antennas, and before you beamform it, before you focus that light, before you point your telescope, you tap that off and put it in a 40-second ring buffer. Okay? And then when we discover FRBs in real time, this process that Kendrick wrote is fast enough that before you overwrite this data in the ring buffer, you know it's there and you can write it to disk. Right? So with this baseband data, this has an advantage, it's completely lossless, right? So this is the rawest data product that the telescope produces. There's no information that Chime has that is not in this data product. Right, completely lossless. In particular, it's polarization sensitive. It has uncertainty principle limited resolution. Right, so the only limitation on what your time resolution and your frequency resolution is a fundamental property of Fourier transforms. And then critically, we haven't pointed our telescope yet. We haven't focused that light from our telescope yet when we see this data. So we have to do that offline. But then we have the choice of where we point our telescope in offline analysis. And in particular, you can point it in many, many, many locations, right? You can dither around the source and figure out exactly where do I point my telescope to maximize the signal noise. That's similar to what Gaia does for astrometry, right? You know, Gaia achieves astrometry that's much, much better than the diffraction limit because it aggressively samples the PSF. We can do the same thing and allows us to super resolve down to arc minute localizations for our FRBs. Okay, so this has enabled a lot of progress on understanding what FRBs are. So I won't go into all of our results in detail. Just highlight a bunch of them, and then I'll drill down on one or two. But you know, so this question of what is causing FRBs, you know, what are the progenitors of the FRBs? You know, the hints that we've been able to pull out of this. So you know, we have new observations like detections of FRBs at low frequencies. There are subpopulations of sources that emit repeat bursts, so single spots in the sky that emit more than one fast radio burst at the same dispersion. Right, so those seem to be those are definitely a multiple burst coming from the same source. Prior to CHIME, there was one such known repeating source. Now there are something like 30, 40 that we've released. We've observed periodicities in the FRB signals, both on sort of week-long timescales. Right, so there's this FRB that is a repeater, and those repeats happen in a four-day window in a strict 16-day periodicity. Kendrick was very involved in this work. Kendrick was also involved in this one, which is an FRB that has a very short timescale periodicity, right? So a series of bursts that seem to be strictly periodic every 100 milliseconds. And then there's some localizations of repeaters, right? Some things about environments I'll talk about in a little bit more detail, like a repeater that was localized to a nearby star-forming region of a nearby galaxy, and a repeater coming from a globular cluster in M81, and a fast radio burst coming from a galactic magnetar. So let me talk about this last one for a second. So this was, one of the most exciting developments in our field, which was we saw an FRB coming from a galactic source, SGR, so soft gamma ray repeater 1935 plus 21. Here's the data from that. So here, this is just like the dynamic spectrum I showed before, frequency versus time, except for that dispersion delay has been taken out. We've lined up the pulse so you can better see the morphology. You see there's two bursts separated by about 30 milliseconds in time. And it's temporally coincident with X-ray bursts coming from a galactic soft gamma ray repeater. So this is a radio burst anyway that was coming from a galactic source, whereas most FRBs come from extragalactic sources. And in fact, this was very, very bright. Its flux was more than 100 kilojanskis, so thousands of times brighter than a typical fast radio burst. But it's also very, very nearby. So energetically, we had to figure out, you know, how to best classify this, right? And so if you look at this sort of transient phase space, which is its intrinsic luminosity, right? So this is after, you know, brightness taking into account distance, right? And its duration, you know, here are pulsars down here, the millisecond long transients, but not very luminous, and RRATs, rotating radio transients. The FRBs live up here, and this galactic magnetar lives here, right? So it's, in terms of intrinsic luminosity, it's much more FRB-like than pulsar-like. So even though it's in our galaxy, it is an FRB, Emily. we can debate. And in fact, since that discovery, there have been other FRBs that are extragalactic that are less luminous even than this galactic radio source. And so this makes it more FRB-like than pulsar-like, certainly. This was associated with a galactic magnetar, right? So this is pointing at magnetars as the progenitors of fast radio bursts, right? You've got magnetars are young neutron stars with vast quantities of energy stored in very strong magnetic fields, okay? And they are the favored progenitors of FRBs. Even before this observation, they are the favored progenitors of FRBs just because of energetics, the short time scale. It was thought that it was easy to make, or at least possible to make, magnetars make these radio bursts. Now we have the direct association, which means that at least some fraction of FRBs come from magnetars. And then we have, there's some observations that associate FRBs with star formation. Magnetars are very, very young objects. They typically live of only a few thousand years. So they have to be near star formation. So the any association with star formation favors magnetars. And then you have these observations of periodicity on both week-long timescales and 100 millisecond timescales. And that, you know, you can make fit into this picture, right, using sort of precession or orbits or something to generate periodicity. So I think this kind of holds together reasonably well as, you know, favoring a magnetar progenitor for fast ray bursts. However, the source environments are a little bit more mixed, right? So an example is this particular source. This is a repeating FRB. And the fact that it was repeating allowed us to follow it up in VLBI, right, and get very, very precise localizations for this fast ray burst, right? So here's the localization. You can't even see the contour. It's very, very tiny, right, because it's VLBI. It's very, very precise. If you look at it in Hubble follow-up, what you see is that very near this sort of V-shaped star-forming region, right? So this is an association with star formation, which is good for the magnetar hypothesis. However, it's not quite in the star-forming region. In fact, it's inconsistent with being exactly coincident with star formation. It's about 60 parsec offset. And actually, that's bad for magnetars because 60 parsecs doesn't sound like a lot, but magnetars are so youthful, right? And they live such short periods of time. It's really hard to get a magnetar 60 parsecs away from star formation. Okay? And so this is sort of like a mixed result for the magnetar hypothesis, right? It's not quite consistent, even though there is some spatial association, but not perfect coincidence with star formation. But anyway, 60 parsecs might not seem like a lot, so maybe that's not too convincing. But this one's even more convincing, right? So here's another repeater that was also followed up in VLBI. It was localized to this region in the halo in the outskirts of M81. And when it was precisely localized, it was found to be in a globular cluster that is orbiting M81. So this is completely inconsistent with any sort of star formation coincidence, because globular clusters are very old stellar populations. They, you know, a typical globular cluster hasn't birthed a star in a few billion years, right? And it really, really challenges magnetars. You just shouldn't find through the formation channels that people typically think about when you have magnetars, you just shouldn't find them in globular clusters at all, let alone a halo globular cluster. So this really, really does challenge this idea that magnetars are the universal progenitors of all fast ray bursts.
Core collapse supernovae never seen in these sort of
globular? I think that is correct. Core collapse supernovae are basically never seen. So people talk about accretion-induced collapse. Like, you know, there's globular clusters are very dynamically interesting, or mergers are another way. So I was actually talking with Elliot Cartart at Princeton just a couple weeks ago, and he really likes forming magnetars in globular clusters through binary mergers of white dwarfs. However, you know, we've never seen. You know, certainly the galactic magnetars we know about have never been in a globular cluster, right? So you know, there are channels you might hypothesize exist, but they are definitely not the channels we know of that happen for galactic magnetars. And it's kind of odd that this, you know, M81 is like 3 megaparsecs away, right? So it's kind of odd that the closest fast ray burst we've ever localized, it's kind of one of the two or three that we've ever localized. It would be weird if that was such a rare formation channel, but maybe not impossible. Yeah. So it's hotly debated in the field. All right. So the rub is, you know, the evidence from source localizations is kind of mixed on the magnetar hypothesis. Certainly as the universal progenitor of all fast ray bursts, but this is only a few localizations, right? There's only a handful of data points on source environments. Which would sure be nice if we had more observations of source environments, which brings me to my next topic, which is, you know, the next instrument we'd like to build, which is the Chime FRB Very Long Baseline Interferometry Outrigger project. And so the outriggers address Chime's biggest weakness, which is resolution, right? I told you before that with a baseband system, we can typically localize our fast ray burst to arc minute precision. An arc minute sounds like not terrible, but then you overplot the Hubble Deep Field and you realize that there's like a lot of galaxies in an arc minute, right? And so you typically just don't know. Not only do you not know the source environment for a fast radio burst, but you don't even know what galaxy it is. There could be any of hundreds of galaxies could be the host for a chime localized FRB. And then furthermore, you know, there's clearly two types of localizations, right? You could have traditional interferometric localizations that look kind of like this one, right? This is typically arc second precision, okay? And those are great for identifying what the host galaxy is, and that gives you things like the redshift, which is fantastic, but has limited detail in terms of how much information you have about the source environment. You can kind of measure, oh, it's, you know, this far from the center, and that's kind of it, right? In contrast with very long baseline interferometry, which gives you sort of milliarc second scale localizations, and that's really that detailed information that tells you, oh, it's this star-forming knot, or, you know, right at the galactic nucleus, or it's in a globular cluster, right? That super detailed information is clearly gives you more information about the environments of the progenitor than traditional interferometry. So the CHIME FRB Very Long Baseline Outrigger Interferometry Outriggers project is an initiative to build small copies of CHIME distributed all across North America that will localize. So the goal is to localize FRBs with very long baseline interferometry. So each one of these copies of CHIME is about an eighth of CHIME's total collecting area, so smaller. The one in Green Bank, the one out in east, has to be rolled on its side, right? Because CHIME looks straight up, right? And straight up in Green Bank is not in Penticton is not straight up in Green Bank, so you kind of roll it to look westward. But otherwise, you know, it is optic. They are each optically, you know, very, very similar, and the analog systems and the digital systems are all very, very similar to CHIME. And so the goal of this project is to localize essentially every CHIME detected FRB, which should be thousands ultimately, to better than 50 milliarc second precision. And this turns out to be really, really, really hard, right? And that's because VLBI is like this super targeted technique, right? You typically, you know exactly what you want to study when you do VLBI. You point your array of telescopes at this thing and you study it to death, right? And here we don't know where we're pointing our telescope, where we're observing. We don't know when we're observing. We're just trying to do VLBI kind of like blindly. And that's unprecedented. So what specifically are the challenges for doing sort of a wide field synoptic VLBI of sources you don't know when they're going to happen? So if one is just recording the data, right? So the data you need to record has to be phase preserving, right? You have to be able to correlate this data, right? It's all the information in interferometry is in the phase. And there's a fundamental scaling for phase preserving data that it always scales as the field of view times the collecting area times the bandwidth of your telescope. And it's like this product of things is the thing that CHIME was optimized to make big, right? This is kind of like your mapping speed, right? So CHIME, we designed CHIME to see as much of the sky with as much sensitivity over as much band as possible. So we've made this optimally hard for us. So the CHIME data rate is like 100 times the HT data rate, which is the next biggest VLBI recorder that exists. Similarly, calibration is really, really hard, right? So we've have to calibrate things like clock synchronization. We have to calibrate the ionosphere, right? And we don't actually know when to calibrate or where on the sky to calibrate. Right, and so we need sort of an always ready calibration solution. All right, so just to convince you that this is in fact possible, so the recording system is actually a solved problem. So I actually already showed you what the solution is. Right, this baseband data is exactly the data we need to do VLBI, and I already showed you that we have the ability to record it on CHIME. And then at the outriggers, we do the exact same thing, but it's even simpler, because at the outriggers, you don't need to point the telescope a priori. You don't need to search for FRBs, right? CHIME is going to search for FRBs. CHIME is going to find the FRBs. You send the trigger over the internet and trigger these recordings and the outriggers just passively collect data and write it to disk when you need it. To solve the calibration challenges, my lab in collaboration with West Virginia University and some folks in Toronto, although I note that neither of those institutions are here. It's because Pranav moved from SBU to Yale and Thomas moved from Toronto to Chile. Oh, actually, Toronto is here, but he was at MIT when he did this. But anyway. So we embarked on a campaign to prototype these technologies with small telescopes located in Algonquin, not too far from here, and an array of telescopes that was built for this purpose in Green Bank. And with this system, we were able to prototype all these data collection and calibration methods, and we were able to achieve the first ever VLBI localization of a fast radio burst that wasn't in repeater follow-up, right? So you can always, VLBI has been done before by following up a repeat source because you know where to point your telescope and you just wait. But it had never been done at detection time. And this is the first VLBI localization at detection. Here's the galaxy. You have to zoom in twice before you can even see the statistical uncertainties because VLBI is very, very precise. The systematic uncertainties are completely dominant. But nonetheless, it's a very, very precise localization to the disk of an edge-on galaxy at redshift 0.18. Okay, but that prototyping campaign is over. So what's happening now? We are building the real outrigger. So this is the outrigger that's in the interior of BC, about 85 kilometers from Chime. This system is undergoing commissioning right now. Similarly, here's the one in Green Bank. The steel all exists. The analog instrumentation, a lot of it is there. And the digital instrumentation is like sitting in my lab and waiting to be deployed. And hopefully that happens very soon. And I won't show you Hat Creek because it's still just like a muddy patch of ground. But hopefully we get to break ground on that fairly soon. And once we do, it should go up pretty quick. So the end result of this campaign is going to be thousands of fast radio bursts. Each one of them, we're going to have the DMs, which we already have. But then these very precise localizations, right, which will give us host galaxies and will give us redshifts. Right? So this is going to be really, really great for solving that environmental problem. Right, we'll be able to get very detailed follow-up and see where do these things live. But it will actually also be great for another application, and that application is cosmological probes. Right, so how would you use this data set of thousands of FRBs with DMs and localizations and redshifts for cosmology? And the opportunity here is to go after is this dispersion, right? And particularly to use dispersion as a probe of large-scale structure. So, and the powerful thing is that the dispersion counts every electron, every free electron along the line of sight, okay? And the baryons are 90% ionized, so it's actually counting up where 90% of the baryons are in the universe, okay, through the dispersion. All right, so how do we expect the baryons to be distributed in the large-scale structure? Okay, so let's turn to simulations and say, what should baryons look like in the large-scale structure? How are they distributed? So here's two simulations. This is Illustris and Illustris TNG. Okay, so these are two simulations run by the same group of the same patch of the universe. You see they're identical, right, at least initially. But they're run 4 years apart with different physics for different subgrid physics, different astrophysics for what happens on very small scales, right? So these are different treatments of feedback processes in star formation. And you see, you get cosmological, and I'm plotting the gas density, right? Where are the baryons, okay? And so structure formation starts as you expect it would be, but then you start seeing these feedback events, right? Star formation and active galactic nuclei start pushing the baryons out of the halos, okay? These get increasingly violent, right? So this is 1 megaparsec scale. So the redshift counter is really tiny. It's way up there. So right now we're at redshift 1-ish. Okay, and this gets increasingly violent and starts pushing and redistributing baryons on sort of megaparsec scales. And you see by redshift 1 or a little bit lower, these simulations that are the same patch of the universe, run with the same code with different subgrid physics, start to diverge dramatically, right? And then once you get towards redshift 0, you can no longer tell that this is the same patch of the universe, right? They have completely diverged. So if you were to plot the dark matter instead of the gas, these would be almost indistinguishable, right? But since you're plotting the gas, they just look nothing alike. Okay? And so that's just a statement of our ignorance about how baryons are distributed on sort of megaparsec scales, right? So why do we know nothing about how baryons are distributed on megaparsec scales? And the answer is feedback. Right? So feedback is this process in galaxy formation that regulates star formation, right? So where does, how does star formation happen, right? So all the baryons start in the IGM, right? They have to, in the intergalactic medium, they have to fall into potentials, they have to radiatively cool, right? And to eventually become cold gas and galaxies, and that's what can then turn into stars and build the galaxy, okay? However, once it's, some of those stars will go supernova and they will inject energy into that gas and they'll reheat the gas, right? And regulate that star formation, reduce the amount of fuel there is for star formation. Similarly, that same gas can accrete onto active galactic nuclei, right? And those galactic, those AGN can launch jets, right? And they can inject momentum and push galaxy gas around, mix it up and prevent it from falling to the potentials, right? Or push it out of the potentials. Okay. And so it's this feedback loop, right? This negative feedback loop regulates star formation. And in fact, it overregulates star formation, right? To the extent that, you know, star formation peaks around redshift 2 and then cuts off very aggressively after that, and you know, and it sort of pitters along after that. And this is a very complicated process. And so why is it very so poorly constrained, right? So feedback disrupts the cooling of the IGM, right? And that starves the galaxies of the cold gas that needs to form stars, right? But our observables for feedback are galaxies or they're stars. Sometimes there's cold gas if you're lucky, right? But these are all secondary results of feedback, right? The thing that feedback does, like our observables that we currently have are, you've gone around the feedback loop a few times, right? But the primary result of feedback is on the IGM, which is itself unobservable, right? It's only after you've gone around the feedback loop a few times that you have an observable in terms of the stars, the AGN. That's not the direct, our observables are not the direct result of feedback. It's the IGM that's the direct result of feedback, and it's unobservable. And so feedback is very, very, very poorly constrained, right? Very poorly understood. If you've heard about like the missing baryon problem, this is the missing baryon problem, right? It's just the statement that the IGM contains all the baryons in the universe, or most of them, right? And you cannot observe them, and you can't simulate them. And so where are they, right? We don't know precisely where the IGM is because the simulations are so uncertain and the observations are impossible. FRBs can help, right? So how can FRBs help? So they can measure statistically where the IGM is by proxy of the free electrons, by proxy of the dispersion measures, right? And you can measure statistically where they are in relation to where the red and blue galaxies are. So how is this working? So I take all my ideas from Kendrick, right? So how do you do this in detail, right? So imagine you have a map of galaxies, foreground galaxies. You have, and you also have a bunch of FRBs with dispersion measures that are in the background, right? And so you've got these two maps. You can spherically harmonic do the spherical harmonic transform and cross-correlate and measure this quantity called CLDMG, right? And it turns out if you have the redshifts for the galaxies, there's a very, very simple transform to get to this quantity, which is the electron galaxy, and remember the electrons are just a proxy for the baryons, right? The baryon galaxy cross power spectrum. Okay? And this is a quantity that we can measure with FRBs, and which I claim is hypersensitive to feedback physics. Oh, okay, so but let's say that you're a hardcore cosmologist, you don't care about any of this gastrophysics, right? And so why should you care, right? And this is a measurement that cosmology needs as well, right? For example, measuring where the electrons are breaks a degeneracy in the kinematic Sinyavzeldovich effect. This is this is exactly the thing that Matt Havacherl and Kendrick and collaborators proposed in their paper, right? But there's other applications beyond that, right? For example, the IGM very strongly contaminates weak lensing, right? So the IGM is basically 14% of the matter in the universe, and its power spectrum is order unity uncertain, right? The weak lensing measures the matter power spectrum, and including the baryons in the dark matter, And for the dark matter, it's very easy to connect theory with observations, right? It's pretty easy to forward model that. But for the baryons, I've just argued that it's impossible, and so you can never do percent level weak lensing measurements unless you understand what the baryons are doing. And therefore, you can never get at sort of dark matter physics or dark energy physics that you would like to do with weak lensing. Similarly, you know, if you want to do near field cosmology, right, you want to look at cusps and cores, you want to do missing satellites, right? You would like to know, you know, to test fuzzy dark matter or warm dark matter, right? You need to solve your feedback physics because you don't want to confuse dark matter physics and baryon physics, right? And in particular, feedback can back react, those baryons can back react on the dark matter, disrupt halos, and making it very hard to interpret your near field cosmology measurements. Right? So these are all, you know, very fundamental physics cosmology questions that you cannot answer without understanding feedback much better than we currently do. All right, so with that, I'm at time. So my conclusions are, you know, fast radio bursts are a mysterious and high energy phenomena originating from compact objects. And with CHIME, we are finally sort of discovering thousands of these things and figuring out the physics of what these things are. In particular, you know, a magnetar progenitor is favored now through at least a direct association. But some of the evidence is kind of mixed, right? And we'd like to really understand this a bit better. Fortuitously, VLBI outriggers are here soon, so we'll provide many, many localizations and redshifts and be able to study source environments in much, much more detail than we have been able to before. And as a bonus, right, FRB data will finally allow us to measure the large-scale distribution of baryons, right, which has been unconstrained for a very long time, and that's going to solve this key uncertainty in structure formation, which is a critical input for cosmology. So that's all I had. Thank you very much.
So has anyone taken those two illustrious simulations and implanted FRBs and determined exactly how well you'd be able to distinguish the two?
No. Certainly not. I am working on doing something half as good as that, which is just saying, what do those two simulations predict for this quantity? And how well would this quantity be measured with some sample? Well, actually, Kendrick and Matt Havichurl have already done those forecasts. So both bringing them as this, to this point is I think the sort of the Fisher level of forecast that you might want to do. And then, of course, you'd like to forward model the whole thing, but I think it's premature for that, or maybe not premature, or I just don't have the energy for it.
So if you were to try to do this with, once you have the outriggers for CHIME, what's the primary observational roadblock to getting some interesting constraints out? Is it localization? Is it the
Samples of order 1,000, I think, or a few thousand can do it if you have, but you do need the redshifts. And the reason you need the redshifts is not because the redshift of the FRB is intrinsically important, but you have to subtract off, the scatter and the DM. So the DM power comes from a few sources. Some of it comes from the foreground large-scale structure, that's the signal piece. Some of it comes from the host galaxy, right, which is a noise contribution that you can't get rid of. But some of it comes from the distance scatter, and you'd like to subtract off that third term, right? And so if you have the redshifts, you can subtract off that third term, and that vastly reduces the number of FRBs you need to. You need for this measurement. So I think that having, and I think photo Zs are good enough. So I think having the localizations, identifying the galaxy and getting a photo Z is good enough for this. Speculatively, because I haven't run the numbers.
So given that we expect the origins of FRBs to be neutron stars and the other sort of, growing experimental technique that is interested in neutron stars is like gravitational wave detectors. Mm-hmm. Is there any crosstalk between the two?
Probably not because, not that I can think of immediately. So if magnetars are the progenitor, a magnetar becomes a vanilla neutron star in like 1,000 years.
Okay.
Right? And so, by the time it becomes a LIGO source, you know, it's hasn't been a magnetar in, you know, a billion years or something. So immediately off the top of my head, I can't think of one, but, you know, we could be more, try to be more creative, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I guess there is the possibility that there's a subset of FRBs that come from merger events, because there is certainly a one-off population compared to a repeater population. And, like, for the chime events, like, LIGO did search their, like, O2 data with the overlapping chime FRBs, just in case. But, like, I don't think that there's anything that came out of that.
And, in fact, I hesitate to mention this, but there is a claimed chime FRB neutron star merger temporal and spatial coincidence, which I think is wrong. But I just to say that I'm not ignorant that it exists.
Could you explain why it's wrong? Because it's a Nature paper, so.
Yeah, that's the first reason. No.
No,
I mean, we've got a lot of our own Nature papers, so I should I say that in jest. The coincidence is the way they calculate the probability of coincidence is way, way too aggressive, and a lot of assumptions, a lot of a posteriori, I always struggle with that word, assumptions were made in that calculation, which I disagree with. I think the probability of chance coincidence is more at the tens of percent, maybe as low as 5% level, but not the 10 to the minus 3 that they quote in the paper.
Okay.
So it's, you know, the temporal coincidence is like an hour, and it's just not, you know, Chime sees 3 FRBs a day, right? That's not very unlikely that you see, if you see a gravitational wave event, it's not very unlikely that it happens within an hour of an FRB event. Now they have added spatial coincidence, but the LIGO localization uncertainties are very large. That doesn't even add very much. The big coincidence is which FRB it was associated with, which was the second lowest DM chime FRB. So the second nearest by chime FRB. And they say that is very unlikely, because chime has seen, you know, several hundred events, such events. But I claim, and the LIGO source should be nearby, right? The LIGO's range doesn't go out to, you know, 500 megaparsecs. But, you know, I think that's very, you know, that's kind of an arbitrary a reason to call that FRB special.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you again very, very much.
Thank you.